You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week of May 22nd. I'm Joe Elia. Call us at 1-617-440-4374 with your reactions. Or drop me a note at jelia@nejm.org. This week, we've got an interview with Harlan Krumholz. His paper in BMJ is likely to reset the stopwatch on door-to-balloon standards. A look at the clinical news first. There was another timing of treatment in cardiovascular disease paper this week. It concerned patients with non-ST segment elevation acute coronary syndromes. In the New England Journal of Medicine, it's reported that 3,000 patients randomized to undergo coronary angiography either within 24 hours or at 36 hours or later showed no difference in primary outcomes, which was a composite of death, MI, or stroke by 6 months. However, the earlier intervention group showed some benefit with regard to refractory ischemia. If you run a major teaching hospital, things are likely to get more expensive when the Institute of Medicine's reforms are implemented. The reforms urge that residents be given lesser workloads, be afforded the opportunity for a 5-hour nap during shifts lasting more than 16 hours, and if no naps are afforded, then limiting shifts to 16 hours. Also, the IOM wants better adherence to the 80-hour work week. An analysis in the New England Journal of Medicine says there are many possible outcomes here, given the increased number of handoffs between teams, and patient care could actually suffer. But what's not at issue is that the reforms will cost the average large teaching hospital at least $4 million a year more. Finally, patients taking Flomax for benign prostatic hypertrophy and their ophthalmologists need to be very aware of a JAMA study that shows a higher rate of serious complications after cataract surgery. Flomax, known generically as Tamsulosin, is an alpha blocker, but other alpha blockers don't show this effect. The reason may be that the specific alpha site blocked is similar both in the bladder, where Flomax does its intended work, and in the iris, where it can complicate surgery by producing something known as the floppy iris syndrome. The analysts calculate a number needed to harm of 255. Now, on to the interview. BMJ this week published one of those studies that seems to answer one question, and in doing so, it poses another. The answered question is, in patients with ST segment elevation MI, is intervention sooner than the recommended 90-minute door-to-balloon time useful? Answer, yes. The subsequent question this result poses is, should the new standard of intervention be, say, 15 minutes? And what changes would that require to the current medical system? We've invited Harlan Krumholz, the paper's senior author, to discuss all this. Dr. Krumholz is a cardiologist and a professor of medicine and of epidemiology and public health at Yale. He's also the editor-in-chief of Journal Watch Cardiology, but he's not getting special treatment here because of that, in case anyone's wondering. Welcome, Dr. Krumholz.
Thanks, Joe. I thought I was going to get special treatment.
No, sorry. This is a large prospective study, almost 44,000 patients with STEMI. And the cartoon version of the results in my head is the sooner the patients got PCI, the better off they were in terms of hospital mortality. Now, were you looking for the bottom of the mortality curve, and do you think you found it somewhere near 15 minutes?
Well, it is probably the largest real-world experience that's possible to get. This is building on the American College of Cardiology NCDR, National Cardiovascular Data Registry, database. And, we were kind of trying to answer this question about whether or not 90 minutes is enough, how low should we go, and what's it worth to do it? And, what we found was the faster the better. And now, this would make sort of sense that the sooner you can open the artery, the better the patient does. But actually having the evidence behind it and getting some sense about what the magnitude of benefit that you can experience at every increment of shorter time helps us put into perspective what we're going to get for what it might take to get there.
I see. And so it almost looks like it's CPR. In other words, it looks like, look, the sooner you do this, and you're not doing it yet, why aren't you doing it now? The better off the patient is. And that's a little scary because, you know, in that case, you have people coming in the door of the emergency room, and then everyone gets gets PCI.
Yeah, I know there's a point to that because in order to do it extraordinarily fast, you've got to move quickly, and that means that you're going to have some false positives. You're going to bring people to the lab who actually aren't having a heart attack. And during the day, that might be okay because you have a high suspicion and you are able to pull people to the lab, but what's it mean at night where people have to come in and you're expending a fair amount of resources to do it? And is that really the right thing? I was at a hospital yesterday, actually visiting, and they were telling me a story about a patient who was brought in with a ST segment elevation MI, who they were able to do in about 20 minutes. And the reason they were able to do it that fast was that, they're poised and ready, and they have policies and protocols in place to move quickly. But more than that, they have an organization that links with the ambulance drivers, with the emergency medical services. And they knew that a STEMI was coming in, and so they made a brief, you know, momentary stop in the emergency department just to confirm that, you know, the patient's vital signs and that how they were doing, and they whisk them off to the lab. And actually, they even had a little bit of trouble crossing the lesion. And even with that trouble, they thought they had a time of about 22 minutes. So, you know, these things are possible, especially if we coordinate with the ambulance services. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it depends what time of day it is and as to what it is. To put this in perspective, I think this is important, which is at 15 minutes, we had an adjusted mortality of...
About 3%.
That is in-house mortality, about 2.9%. At 30 minutes, it was 3. So the difference between 15 and 30 was only 0.1, mm-hmm. which would give you a number needed to treat of about 1,000. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you keep going longer, the mortality rate sort of in a graded way goes higher. And when you compare, for example, 90 minutes with 45 minutes, for mm-hmm. example, that's about a 1% difference. That's a number needed to treat of about 100. That's not far off the difference between 2 hours and 90 minutes. That is the absolute delta between 2 hours and 90 minutes. And I think it does tell us that if we can put in place systems, especially in coordination with ambulance services, where we can get to 45 minutes to 60 minutes, we're likely to save more lives. And that's not going to be inconsequential. And so once we've now achieved the 90-minute standard, I don't think it is beyond our reach to get to a 60-minute standard. I will tell you that there were many years when people kept saying 90 minutes is impossible. And when we really started to try to focus on 90, we would be common around the country. In fact, the first guideline that came out with a time on it said 90 plus or minus 30. Huh. And that seems kind of funny because, why do you need plus or minus anyway, and why didn't you do it? It was because they decided, you know, 90 seems like a good place to reach for, but so many people were screaming that you are putting into the guidelines an impossible standard that they were forced to put in this plus or minus 30, which in essence is really a plus 30,
yeah.
And to give people the leeway to go to 120. And the National Medicare quality measure that was being publicly reported for some time was what percent of your patients were being treated under 120 minutes. And it was only when the hospitals and leaders got together and they said, you know, actually, there's a lot of hospitals that are getting under 90, and actually, if we can really organize ourselves so that we aren't, you know, getting rid of the redundancies and all the needless delays, 90 minutes isn't that bad, and we can do it. But it took several years for people to realize that. And now what we are seeing, there's a handful of hospitals in the country that are consistently getting around 60. And it's going to take another paradigm shift for people to say, you know, if we really work with the EMS services and we really hone our systems and work together, we can probably get around 60.
Lee, you mentioned the EMS services. There were some simple recommendations, I don't know whether you were involved with formulating these, about a year ago, where they said that, you know, people... you should be able to activate the cath lab with a single phone call, and there should be, you know, people who are available within, I don't know, what was it, 20 minutes time with a single phone call. Those recommendations didn't mention the EMS services, did they?
Well, that actually was our paper.
It was.
And then that paper was parlayed into the national campaign, the D2B Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
which was put forth by American College of Cardiology and about 38 other partners, and has, I think, been instrumental in helping us improve care. What we did was, it was there were six recommendations, actually, but the sixth recommendation, which was pre-hospital electrocardiogram, was made an optional recommendation. And the reason we did that was because it takes some work to get done. And so the others, which were the emergency medicine doc activates a lab, and they do it with one phone call, and you use data feedback, and the cath people are available within 20, 30 minutes to get there to start the case, as sort of the core four key things that we were looking for. You know, we thought everybody can do that tomorrow. I mean, you could really put that in place essentially within the next week. The pre-hospital electrocardiogram was a little tougher. Mm-hmm. And there was one other one, by the way. It was faster if you had 24-hour coverage of cardiologists in the hospital. And we dropped that because only 4% of the hospitals do it, and we thought that was going to be too tough. But this pre-hospital electrocardiogram was being done by some, but we didn't want to make it a kind of the thing that we were pushing because we wanted to make it it wasn't easy. But we're seeing more and more people do it, and it did show in that study to be associated with significantly faster times. And the places that really do it well, because what we noticed was some places in which they're transmitting the electrocardiogram are then repeating the entire procedure in the emergency department. They're bringing the patient in, they're reevaluating them from ground level, and they are redoing electrocardiograms. And that's not as effective as the places that are like what I saw yesterday, mm-hmm. where they're transmitting, saying we have a STEMI coming in. They're either transmitting the electrocardiogram en route or they trust the EMS people to know what a STEMI looks like. Mm-hmm. And in this case, they stop for minutes, literally, in the emergency department just to lay eyes on the patient. In some places, they actually take them straight to the lab from the emergency room bay. They don't even stop in the emergency room. And those places are just getting amazing times. Mayo Clinic, you know, sent me some cases that are just extraordinary with regard to the speed with which they are providing these interventions. And so the answer, I know there's a long answer, but the thing is, yes, it was in that study.
Yeah.
We did make it optional, so we didn't emphasize it, but it was associated with faster times. And now what we are seeing are more and more people doing it, and what we're seeing also are different approaches, and there's some approaches that are more effective than others in getting it done quickly. And those are the ones that we want to start learning about and disseminating so that people can adopt them.
And it's probably easier now to move that data from the ambulance to the hospital than it was a few years ago.
Well, yeah, actually the funny story about that is that, you know, a lot of companies have put together some very complicated and effective means of transmitting that information. And somebody showed me that they... the ambulance driver has a cell phone. They did the ECG. They take a picture of the ECG with the cell phone, and they just transmit it to the emergency department. So actually, there's some low-tech solutions to that, too.
It only seems low-tech now.
So, that's true.
Are you pursuing this study in BMJ was about what happens in the hospital. Now, are you pursuing what happened to these patients after hospitalization? In other words, you got them to live, to discharge, or many of them, and you know what that survival curve looks like. Are you examining what the door-to-balloon time does to longer-term survival?
That's a good question. We didn't have that opportunity in this data set, and although some people are working to try to merge this data set with some longer-term data, we haven't really been able to do that yet. But most of the information we have suggests that lives you save early are saved, that you don't lose that ground later. And the information from Lytics is pretty clear. The trials all show that you reduced mortality at 35 days, and then when you looked at 10 years, the curves were just as far apart as they were 35 days. Those early lives you saved were you continued to have that benefit throughout. It didn't get any bigger. You didn't get any bigger benefit, but you didn't lose the benefit either. The expectation for this is these lives that you save early are that benefit's going to persist for a long time. We probably should look at that more closely, but everything we've seen so far would indicate that that's true.
Huh. Okay. So I guess the bottom line for a clinician listening into this is to advocate for some of those simple changes that we discussed earlier to activate that cath lab and to be aware of the possibility of working with the EMS services.
Yeah, this way I think about it. We just did, by the way, a survey of a lot of hospitals in the country and saw that many still have not adopted those core recommendations that we had, even as their times have gotten faster. The message to the community really is that you shouldn't be complacent because you've gotten your hospital to have most of the cases under 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it really should continue to look carefully at where needless delays exist and how best to put together a system that's just going to excel with respect to getting patients treatment as quickly as possible. You know, there are all sorts of other considerations, and certainly this shouldn't in any way lead people to neglect the patient and just, you know, make decisions without really carefully looking at the patient and
right.
making the diagnosis. But once there's a strong sense that this is a STEMI, which means getting ECG rapidly, and listening to the patient's history, putting in the context of what the presentation is, working in partnership with EMS, then there should be all effort to get the procedure done as quickly as possible, and there should be no delay because, well, we're comfortably under 90 minutes, so we don't have to rush. No, I think this is a situation where it should be considered like a trauma case, and every minute counts, and every minute is meaningful, and we need to develop the systems that respect every minute.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Dr. Krumholz.
Oh, thanks. Great pleasure, Joe.
We're all ears at 1-617-440-4374. So give us a ring or drop me a note at jelia@nejm.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next week. Enough said.